This program is a production of WAMC News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist Dr. Alan Shartok of the State University.
In this edition of the Legislative Gazette, we'll see how the state's program to combat alcohol abuse is faring. Summer is the time when Governor Cuomo and his staff spend much of their time going through the mountain of bills passed by the legislature. It's a time-consuming process, and it leaves groups which may be affected by a signature or a veto waiting and wondering if the governor will sign. One such group is small business. Here's more from Bill Gralty.
The National Federation of Independent Business is waiting to see what Governor Cuomo does with three bills in particular. One deals with bad checks. For several years, small business has pushed for tougher sanctions against people who paper the town with rubber checks. Up to now, though, those sanctions have been viewed as too tough. So this year, the legislation scaled things back a bit, giving judges more latitude, lowering the damage cap to $500, and replacing triple damages with double.
All in an effort to show that the concern or the objective of the business community is not to be dragging people into court. I think there are some people in the process that felt that there were a lot of small businesses out there rubbing their hands together waiting for this thing to be enacted, because then all of a sudden they would be dragging unsuspecting consumers into court and going after the damages. If you know anything about the business community, you realize that time is money, and that to bring a case like this takes an awful lot of time. It's a big hassle. What we're really interested in is seeing the check covered.
That's Steve Woods, Director of Governmental Relations for the Federation. He says in other states, similar laws have reduced bad checks by as much as 20%.
We think it's a pro-consumer bill, at least for the honest consumers. It would encourage more and more businesses to accept checks as a form of payment, because now they'll have some sanction, some option for collecting on the checks.
And, says Woods, the bill will help business, and that's why it's their number one priority.
It seems to be a problem that's growing, and it's a problem that affects businesses in many different sectors of the economy, not just retailers, but service businesses and other businesses, so that that probably would be the one that we would choose if we had to.
The Federation also wants Governor Cuomo to sign legislation extending workmen's compensation coverage to unincorporated businesses. Most states currently allow this, giving small business a choice of workmen's comp or continuing with private insurance. The third major bill deals with overzealous enforcement by state regulatory agencies. Wood says they want protection for business people who are often ill-equipped to fight what they see as frivolous actions.
The concept behind equal access is simple, and that is that very often there are fines or judgments brought against business people that are of a small enough amount that it's not cost-effective for them to go out and hire an attorney to fight the fine. So in these cases, the cost of principal is very high, and they swallow very hard and they pay the fine, and you know, it builds a very negative feeling in their stomachs about doing business in the state. And our objective again is not to to have a law that will result in a slew of court cases. We really think that this is written in such a way that the standards are very tough. Frivolous is a very difficult standard to prove in court. That as a business person, you'd have to feel pretty darn sure that you had a strong case before you went out and hired an attorney and brought the proceeding.
While those bills hang in the balance, Woods assesses the legislative session as one with some minuses and some pluses.
Well, I think any time you have a session where our personal income tax is reduced, you have to consider it a very, very positive session. We find that as we go out and around the state and go up and down Main Street, New York, and talk to small businesses, that we hear consistently that the personal income tax burden is their number one concern. So that the actions that the legislature took this year to reduce the personal income tax to 9% is a very encouraging sign. I think we were pleased at the end of the session with the activity surrounding proposals to reduce the corporation tax and make some reforms in the corporation tax, which would benefit small businesses and address some of the inequities in the tax code that have plagued small businesses for years. Probably the one minus of the session is that we're very concerned that the state continues to spend at levels well above the rate of inflation. That we were able to cut our tax burden this year primarily because of our tax structure and the fact that during economic upturns, our personal income tax generates revenues at a level higher even than the rate of personal income, so that the money was just rolling in and allowed the state to reduce the rate without really cutting back on their spending. And we think long term that particularly with the deductibility issue hanging over our heads, that the legislature is going to have to do a much better job of bringing spending under control and bringing it down to rates that are comparable with the states around us that we compete with for economic development.
Steve Woods of the National Federation of Independent Business. This is Bill Gralty.
Now let's turn to a contributor, Gerald Benjamin. Jerry is a political scientist and a Republican county legislator from Ulster County.
On any day that the legislature is in session, you would not have too much trouble around the Capitol in Albany finding a New Yorker who will tell you that politics is for the birds. This year, however, you may find one who will tell you that politics is against the birds, and therein lies a tale. In 1984, the legislature passed a bill, drafted in the Department of Environmental Conservation, that prohibited the sale of exotic birds captured in the wild. This measure, a special interest of former State Senator Mike Seymour and Assemblyman Robert Connor, a bird watcher, responded to the shocking conditions under which these birds were captured and transported to the United States. It was signed by the governor over the objections of his counsel and despite a belated lobbying effort by the pet industry. Charged with the implementation of the wild bird law by November of 1985, NCON held a series of hearings and then prepared regulations that adhered to its intent while allowing reasonable exceptions for legitimate purposes. But the 1985 legislative session allowed the industry another shot before implementation was to take place. And in January, the newly formed Empire State Pet Industry Council announced that it had retained one of Albany's most effective political law firms, Hinman, Straub, Pigors, and Manning, at a fee of $2,000 per month to roll back the 1984 law. The pet industry argued that the economic implications for it were not fully considered when the original bill was passed. It suggested further that a ban in a single state would not stop the inhumane treatment of birds and, in fact, would encourage a black market to develop. As a substitute for the ban, the industry proposed an amendment that would allow the sale of birds caught in the wild to be regulated by the DEC to assure their humane treatment. Possessed of far fewer resources than the industry, the New York State Humane Society nevertheless fought back in defense of what it regarded as a landmark law for the nation. Another example of the leading role New York has traditionally taken in protecting animals in the wild. But the state Senate bought the industry's arguments. Thus, the fate of the legislation was left in the hands of the Assembly Environmental Committee in the waning days of the legislative session. During every session, thousands of bills are introduced and hundreds passed. A few, the death penalty, seat belts, toxic torts, get massive publicity, while most get none at all. Yet each bill, no matter how obscure, is enormously important to those who are directly impacted by it or feel passionately about it. On this large number of relatively invisible measures, bills like the wild bird law, does the big money always win once it is engaged? The Assembly Environmental Committee, after what one staffer called the longest and most heated debate of the entire session, decided by a vote of 13 to 10 not to report the pet industry's amendment this year. The 1984 protective legislation will therefore go into effect in November, as planned. New York State is for the birds, after all.
For the last couple of years, one of the state's top priorities has been to fight alcohol abuse and alcoholism. The fight has been waged on several fronts, and the man responsible for directing the action is Bob Scheer, director of the Division of Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse.
My charge is to conduct the state's program to prevent, treat, provide rehabilitative services to people who suffer from alcohol problems. A full range of alcohol problems, to be sure. Those that are related to the short-term use of alcohol, those that are related to alcohol dependence. But our mission really is not to provide cure. Our mission is to conduct those states' efforts that are designed to either prevent those problems or respond to them. Some of those are designed to provide a curative type response to people who have alcohol dependence, for example. We are a relatively small scale in terms of direct state operations. We're a relatively small part of the overall public efforts and publicly regulated efforts to treat alcoholic people and their families. We directly provide services to about 5,000 people a year directly. A much larger number are being served in the publicly supported or regulated alcoholism service system. We estimate that with the major change that we've seen in the past year, we've probably gone from about 8% of service need being met to a reasonable prediction that by the end of this year we'll be meeting maybe 10 or 11% of service need.
That doesn't sound very good. The other percentage of that would be that 90% of the service need is not being met.
As far as we can tell, 90% of people who need services for alcohol problems, who need some help, are not getting them.
It's your contention that by not doing that, that we are essentially costing ourselves a lot more money by not doing the proper preventative work. Could you explain that?
Both in terms of prevention and treatment. In terms of prevention, there are a number of problems that produce a fairly direct cost to the society that result from the use of alcohol by alcoholic people and by people who are not alcoholic. Those things that have to do with traumatic injuries, not just car crashes, but traumatic injuries at home, people who are hurt in falls and fires and drowning. The cost to the society that results from all of that is enormous. Obviously, a substantial overrepresentation in within that population that experiences those problems are people who are alcohol dependent or alcoholic, who drink a great deal on a regular basis, are much more likely to encounter physical injuries. They're also much more likely to encounter illnesses resulting from the use of alcohol, other than alcoholism itself. All of those costs, which are estimated to cost the New York State economy somewhere between $8 and $10 billion a year now, by the latest estimates, by the latest federal estimates, a large proportion of those would not be experienced were alcoholic people who were identified, and given effective treatment. Much of our health care bill, for example, goes into repairing livers, and to repairing stomachs, and to repairing broken bones, injured by alcoholic people in the course of their alcohol use, who are never given the opportunity to have treatment for alcoholism.
But Bob, let me stop you for a second and say there's a whole bunch of people out there, and to some degree, me, who say, come on, we've heard all this before, you know, you're talking about, A, we don't have the slightest real idea about how to stop alcoholism. As you say, you can deal with prevention, but we don't know about cure, so this is really just throwing a whole lot of money down the rat hole, and this society is so permeated by alcoholism that it really doesn't matter. How do you respond to that?
You're wrong. That's not the case. We do know a great deal about how to effectively treat alcoholic people. When we identify them, and the earlier we identify them, we know for sure that our treatment is more effective, so that we can dramatically reduce the cost to business and industry, the cost in terms of lost employment and productivity. These are not costs that are going to come out of anybody's checkbook. When your career comes to an end 10 years earlier as a result of heavy alcohol use over a period of your lifetime, nobody's going to be able to say, well, there's the cost of that. Nobody's going to be able to nail it down, and it's not going to be directly experienced by anybody other than you. So it's not going to be a direct cash savings in every case. But we do know how to treat alcoholism. Our treatment, current modern treatment of alcoholism, is very effective. We're getting positive responses in terms of recovery, cessation of alcohol use, and a recovery in terms of social and psychological rehabilitation more than half the time with people who are going into and completing alcoholism treatment. Now, we still have large numbers of people who aren't getting it. And those people we know continue to get help in the form of medical care and so on for other problems. I'll just give you an example. If you treat an alcoholic person for alcoholism, the savings in their subsequent use of health care benefits pays off the cost of their treatment for alcoholism in 2 to 3 years.
Okay, let me shift grounds. How political has alcoholism become? In other words, is this something that you're likely to see fought out between Republicans and Democrats in the legislature?
No, certainly not. It is not partisan political. I think we saw this with the purchase age. This was an effort that took us a couple of years of hard work in the legislature, and where you saw people making their decisions on this issue was not partisan political lines. People drew their conclusions about how to deal with this based on very, very strong personal feelings, and I think the strength of those feelings was very evident. That seems to be true of issues related to alcohol generally. People tend to have very strong views and very strong feelings about alcohol issues once you address them. If you don't address them, they just seem to always be in the background and lost out of sight. But once you address them, they tend to evoke pretty strong feelings. So no, it's not partisan political, but you do see that it becomes heated once an alcohol issue is open for examination.
There's a tremendous amount of liquor that flows around the legislature. Therefore, I've got to believe that the same statistics that exist otherwise, that there are a lot of alcoholics in the legislature, are there. Do you think that some of your efforts to reform the use of alcohol in the public policy process is at all affected by the fact that legislators, that I've seen anyway, many of them like to drink?
Let me broaden it just a little bit. And if you think,
why should I?
Well, I think it'll be instructive. And if you think that I'm dodging too much, you can always bring me back to it. But it is my firm belief that ignorance about the nature of alcohol and alcoholism and prejudice against the victims of alcohol problems have a controlling influence over all public policies and response, not just in terms of the view of legislators, but people who make public policy at every level are, in fact, people who consume the same body of information, who live in the same culture, who have the same cultural prejudices about alcohol and alcoholism. And we are all, as a result, dealing with, to a large degree, a distorted body of information, a body of ideas that is prejudiced, that is biased in a particular direction, that is harmful to the interests of alcoholic people. And it is a consequence of that, I believe, that we have public policies that are not helpful very often, much of the time. Now, certainly a part of that is the fact that many people are too sensitive personally to be able to deal with the issue objectively. Not only those who are in trouble with alcohol themselves, but those who have been affected by alcoholism in another family member, certainly those who have been affected by the consequences of the behavior of some alcoholic person, the person whose friend or relative is injured by a drunk driver, for example. I mean, that produces a very powerful emotional experience that does have a substantial influence. And I think that it is that mostly controls the policy decisions. I do not think that we have in New York or in the United States or at any level of government that I've come into contact with very, very many policies that are reasoned into on an objective analysis of facts. There's just a lot more going on than that.
The liquor lobby has been very unhappy with you, Bob, this year over the drinking age, the purchase age, and some other issues. They've said that you were for a minor league type of prohibition and everything else. How does it feel to know that there's a major, influential, moneyed group of people out there who, frankly, in terms of their institutional relationship with you, hate your guts?
Well, the industry, the alcoholic beverage industry, does not really act as a single element. This past year, because we were working on changes in the purchase age, the Tavern Keepers Association particularly was opposing that effort, and so we came into some philosophical conflict there. Different parts of the industry, for example, in future years, I expect we'll see much more conflict around the subject of advertising of alcoholic beverages, and I expect that not only the alcoholic beverage industry, but major elements of the electronic communications industry generally will find themselves in opposition to people who are interested primarily in the public health.
But isn't it remarkable? Everybody knows this stuff just kills people. It's bad for people. It does all of these health ills. And yet there seems to be so much ingrained resistance that sometimes doing what you know needs to be done seems almost impossible.
Well, certainly there remains about $1 billion a year worth of efforts to sell an image and an idea about alcohol that is not wholly correct, that is not wholly accurate, that I think distorts the public understanding not only of alcohol and alcoholism, but also of alcoholic people.
You're referring to their advertising $1 billion, right?
Yes, absolutely. I think that as long as we have a single element, often a distorted element of our experience with alcohol presented overwhelmingly to young people and to others as well, to policymakers as well, as long as your image that you see 10, 15, 20 times a day is of patriotism or economic success or sexual prowess, then our being able to remind you of the rest of that picture just isn't going to be possible. So yeah, I think people are... The view of the culture is distorted about alcohol, and principally as a result of alcohol advertising.
Let me see if I can get tricky with you. If I were king, and I could absolutely enforce it, and somebody said to me, knowing what you know about alcoholism, would you prohibit its consumption, assuming that you could make it stick? My answer to that would be yes. I think it's bad enough so that I would. What about you, Bob?
If I were the omnipotent dictator.
Right.
I have other considerations. I have the same. I have libertarian concerns. I have concerns about human freedom and so on. And those would prevent me from taking the job of dictator. So I wouldn't take on the responsibility. Certainly, knowing what I know about alcohol, I would not deal with alcohol with any substantially different rules than I deal with Valium, marijuana, or cocaine, or barbiturates. All of which have, from a purely biochemical, pharmacological standpoint, a very high level of risk if they're used without regulation, if they're used without supervision of someone who knows what they're doing.
To sum up, do you think you're spitting in the ocean on this issue?
I think that it will be a very long time before we are able to make very significant major progress in reducing alcohol problems in the society. I think that every step that we take, because we're at such a preliminary preliminary point, every step we take, however small, from where we are, is an enormous one, and that the consequences and the benefits of every single action that we take at this very, very preliminary level have enormous impact. As I say, we can only make a very small distance towards an ultimate idealized goal, but changing even in 1 year to the next by an increase in interest on the part of the state government has resulted in a 25% increase in state spending on alcohol problems this year over last. So I think that while we're making small steps toward an ultimate or an ideal goal, we're making significant steps compared to where we've been, and the consequences are really going to be very powerful. Even though they're small efforts, they are extremely significant ones. A lot of lives are going to be saved by our efforts around the purchase age and our efforts around drunk driving. If we can get some effort, some balance to the distorted message about alcohol and alcoholism that the public currently receives, for example, if we were to get an equal time provision in the electronic media.
Every time there's a beer commercial, you could have an anti-alcoholism commercial.
A health message or a prevention message every time that there is an advertisement for alcohol, a health warning. Those, if we were able to achieve that, and there is now a bill in the Congress that would propose to give that sort of provision, I think that an enormous amount of progress could be made, much in the way that we've made progress against smoking. I mean, if you'd asked me 20 years ago or 30 years ago, how are we ever going to be able to bring our smoking problem under control, I would have been a whole lot more pessimistic than I am now. And we've seen results. We've seen that smoking among young people is declining, that being able to make an effective step on advertising, being able to give a more balanced message, a more accurate message to the public, has made an enormous difference. And I don't believe that it would be possible to isolate all of the positive cultural change that's happened since then from that event. I think the reason that the change in public policies about where you may smoke, the size of the no smoking section on the airplane, which I see grow every time I fly on the airplane, I think that those are things that cannot be divorced from the fact that we took a positive, courageous step as a matter of public policy many years ago with respect to the advertising of tobacco. And I think the same thing can happen with alcohol. I certainly hope it does. Many other areas. We are making progress in treatment. I think that we're very soon to see a much closer step towards universal insurance coverage. My hope is that we will see a mandate by our legislature that will require that every health insurance policy in the state cover alcoholism treatment as it's currently being delivered, modern alcoholism treatment. I believe that that's achievable. I expect to see that in my lifetime, and I think that'll make an enormous difference in who gets help.
Commissioner Bob Scheer.
Some summertime and the living is easy. But with the legislature gone, what is the press to do? Answer, go for sales. And who is most willing to oblige? None other than His Excellency Governor Mario Matthew Cuomo, who once again has amused himself by giving the press a Parkinsonian lesson in reasoning that has them shaking their heads collectively. This time, it's the raises for the hapless Bobby Abrams, the Democratic Attorney General, and the Republican Comptroller Ned Regan. These two gentlemen say they deserve more than the $85,000 that they're now pulling in. They're right, of course. Anyone exercising the kind of responsibility they do in the private sector would be pulling in three times the amount they're paid. But the governor says he won't recommend raises for statewide elected officials, including himself. He says that he considers it an honor to serve, and he says that it doesn't matter that a lot of people in state government make more than he does. He always makes the point that his historic rival, Ed Koch of the Big Apple, makes substantially more than he does. Of course, the governor does get that mansion and all the perks, but all of that aside, the governor's position is honorable. It's also the kind of thing that the public eats up. By taking the position, which I believe is motivated by his antithetical relationship with his Attorney General Robert Abrams, Cuomo keeps Abrams, a notoriously ambitious man, down. As for the Republican controller, he says, let the Republican Senate give him his raise. I'm only the governor. Another beautiful move, of course. If the Republicans give Regan the raise, Cuomo can turn around and say, look at that, they're always talking about economy and government, and they go around raising people's salaries. The fact that he has okayed substantial raises for his own staff won't mean a thing. It'll be lost in the shuffle. Cuomo seems to know that all of this is highly symbolic, and I'll bet that he knows that sooner or later they'll get their raises. And then there will be Mario Cuomo saying, don't look at me. I wouldn't take the money for myself, and I didn't give it to them. But to further put it into perspective, just where was Mario Cuomo when the legislature raised their salaries last year? I didn't hear a peep then. That's our show for this week. Join us again next week for another look at state government and politics. Bill Gralty produces and edits this program. Rick Lepkowski is associate editor. Please address comments and questions to us at WAMC Box 13000, Albany, New York 12212. I'm Alan Chartok.
The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC News. Alan Chartok is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds provided by the State University of New York College at New Paltz.